It's an honor for me always to have an opportunity to speak to you. But it's really even more of a privilege, I think, just to be a part of this congregation. I'm constantly thankful to God that through His providence, He led Kay and me to this group a number of years ago. It's been a blessing to us. It was a blessing when there were just two of us. And this is a wonderful place, I think, to raise a family. And those that are just now having children should be excited about being among others who really care about God and want to serve Him. And I appreciated the thoughts that Marty expressed in his prayer about how we should be helping one another and concerned about one another and doing those things as an entire group to encourage each other to make it to heaven. If you were to look at the New Testament and think about all the different books that make up the New Testament, you of course would quickly notice the fact that a significant portion of them are simply letters that Paul wrote. And the majority of the letters that Paul wrote were addressed to churches. Although on a couple of occasions, such as Galatians, he wrote to a group of churches. And Romans maybe wasn't addressed to a specific church, but maybe to all the Christians that lived in Rome. But there's a large group. To three men did Paul write a personal letter that has made it into our New Testament. He wrote, of course, a letter to Philemon, a very short letter, very specific topic, telling Philemon some things that he needed to do in his relationship with a runaway slave named Onesimus. But on three occasions, Paul wrote to two men. I may have said that a little wrong. He wrote two letters to Timothy, and he wrote one letter to Titus, which were letters that he wrote to men that he was very well acquainted with, very close to. And in those letters, I think that we'll find a great deal of material. But though they're personal letters, there's a great deal of thoughts in those that will help us to be encouraged to serve God better. Paul had a very special relationship with both Timothy and Titus. In fact, it appears that Timothy accompanied Paul on his second missionary journey when Timothy more than likely was a teenager. And Paul once told the Philippians in his letter to them that he knew of no one that would care for them the same way that Timothy did. Wouldn't that be a wonderful compliment? No one's going to care for you or take care of you the way that Timothy will. And he went on to say that Timothy to Paul was as a son, or had served him as a son would in working in the gospel. Of Titus, Paul had some other things to say to the Corinthians. It's very clear that there was an occasion when Paul was extremely discouraged coming into Macedonia, worried about the Corinthian church. And when Titus comes to him in 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 6, Paul tells the Corinthians that he was greatly comforted by Titus's coming. And part of that was just the fact Titus was bringing good news, saying that the Corinthians had done well. But it's also very obvious that he felt that just being with Titus, just the coming of Titus, was a great encouragement to Paul. So he was very close to these two men. But by the time he writes these letters to them, it's at least a good 15 years after the time when Timothy first went with him on that second missionary journey. And because of that, I think that it's pretty clear that Timothy must have been at least in his early 30s. And Titus, I think, and I don't know why I think this, I can't put a good handle on it, but I think Titus may have been a few years older than even that. And it's also clear, just as a side note, I want to point out that what initially sparked my interest and some of the thoughts that we'll go through tonight was when I was teaching what then was the fourth and fifth grade classes this summer on the letters of Paul. We came across the letters to Titus and to Timothy, and I got to thinking about the fact that Timothy and Titus were probably pretty close to my age. I'm a little bit older than early 30s, but close enough. And I paid a little more attention to those letters maybe than I have before, thinking those were men in not too different a circumstance than I'm in. But not only that, I have to admit that I was a little encouraged by the fourth chapter of 1 Timothy when he was told to not allow anyone to despise his youth. So I felt, well, maybe I'm not that far away yet from being described as youthful, though my gray hairs usually kind of give away most of that. But it was somewhat of an encouragement to recognize that. But these men, by the time that Paul writes them, they're veterans in the service of the Lord. They may be somewhat young in regard to some of their responsibility. They're told to talk to older men and to teach men how to be elders and so forth. But nevertheless, they really are veterans and serving God. You might wonder, why would Paul bother to write to men who seem to be so grounded already in the truth and so grounded in their own service to God? In fact, he explains to Timothy one of the reasons why he wrote in the third chapter, down in verse 15. He says, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which he goes on to describe as being the church of the living God. Here's Timothy. He says, Timothy, I want you to have a good understanding of exactly how you ought to act, how you ought to behave among other Christians within the church, and what you ought to do for them and what you should expect from them. To Titus, in Titus, the third chapter in verse 8, although this is really more of instructions he gave Titus, I think it's pretty clear he wanted Titus to do the same. And he says in verse 8, toward the middle of that, he says, I want you to affirm constantly that those who have believed in God should be careful to maintain good works. And here's a man who's clearly doing good works, but he says, you be careful that you maintain them and that you continue on in doing those things. There are several things also that Paul tells Titus and Timothy, not just to encourage them, but some things that they should tell other people. And on some occasions, he just kind of covers the gamut. For example, the second chapter of Titus, beginning with about verse 1, he says, Titus, I want you to tell the young women this, and I want you to tell the older women this, and I want you to tell the young men that, and I want you to tell the older men that. He covers just about everybody. You've got to give them some instructions. But what's particularly noteworthy to me is the fact that much of what he has to say to these men that they need to tell others about are really addressed to men. There are some responsibilities and some opportunities that men have that Paul wanted Titus and Timothy to encourage men to rise up to be able to do that. The most obvious example, of course, is the fact that in Titus and in 1 Timothy, there are instructions given as to the qualifications of an elder. And it begins to very start that these need to be men. And I don't want to lose half of my audience tonight. In fact, we were talking in the elders and deacons meeting about how hard it is to get people to listen as long as we expect you to on occasions like this. So I don't want to lose half of you at the beginning anyway. So if you're thinking, well, this is going to be addressed to men and I'm a woman, I don't need to listen to this. There is a section in here. We want to look very carefully at the goals, the spiritual goals that I think that are specifically given to men. But there are certain characteristics that we need to have. There's a certain character that's expected of men that will allow them to accomplish those goals. Now, the spiritual goals that women have will require exactly the same character. So I'm going to try to get you back at a certain point. So don't drift away too far. I've got to get you to pay attention, at least at that point. What kind of character is it that God expects of us? But I want us to notice at the beginning that there are several spiritual goals that Paul had in mind for men that he wanted Titus and Timothy to get across to them. And some of these goals are contained within these overall goals of becoming a deacon or becoming an elder. And among the very first one, I think it's very obvious that Paul wanted men to find for themselves faithful wives, or to have wives who are faithful in their service to God. In both Timothy and Titus, it's explained that elders are to be the husbands of one wife. And I think implied in that is that they have had a successful marriage, that they are the kind of men who've been able to successfully live with a wife. But in the instructions in regard to the qualifications of a deacon, if you look over in 1 Timothy, the third chapter, in verse 11, it says this about the wives of deacons, and I think it's quite clear that this would certainly be implied to the wives of elders as well. It says, likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, that is, gossipers, temperate, faithful in all things. Very high standards set for the women of those that are deacons. And it's quite obvious that Paul would have encouraged Titus and Timothy to in turn to encourage young men that they, in thinking about the wives that they would take, that they should look for women who are going to be faithful to the Lord. There is no greater quality that a young man can seek to find in a prospective wife than the quality of someone who already is a child of God and who deeply wants to serve God. That above all else is what you ought to desire in someone you're going to share your entire life with. And there's some other reasons as well, I think, why a young person ought to desire a wife who truly wants to serve God. For example, if a man has decided that one day he would like to be a deacon, and even beyond that, we're going to talk about this a little bit more, about being an elder. It's extremely important to have a faithful wife. Not just because it says it here. You know, you got to check off a qualification. Think about how hard it is to become a person like these deacons and elders are described as being. Think how hard it is to get to a point where a man is qualified to lead others spiritually as an elder, unless he's had a wife who was there to encourage him. Someone who cared also about God and could tell him things and serve as a balance in his life. How important that is. I think also that it's intended to be a test of men who might serve God in this capacity. After all, a man who's been able to help his wife to be faithful has certainly accomplished a great deal. Now, we can't control other people. And there are many very faithful men who unfortunately have been married to wives who chose not to serve God through no fault of their own. They've done everything they could to encourage them, but their wives simply have chosen not to serve God. But nevertheless, as a general rule, it's certainly true that we have, more than anyone else, a husband has influence with a wife, and the wife has influence over the husband. And if there's no one in our life who's going to influence us more than our spouse, then it's certainly a responsibility for a man early on in his life to decide, I'm going to be a good spiritual encouragement to my wife. I'm going to help her to be faithful as I expect her to help me. But there's another spiritual goal, I think, as well, contained within these instructions, or these qualifications, rather, that are given to both deacons and to elders. And that is that they are to rule their children well. You'll see this in the passage in 1 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, in verse 4, in regard to elders, they are to rule their own house while having children in submission with all reverence. And the deacons down in verse 12 are said to be ones who rule their children and their own houses well. In Titus 1, in verse 6, elders are ones who are to have faithful children. Obviously, having taught their children, encouraged them to such an extent that those children turn out to be ones who want to also serve God. That's a goal by itself. If we had nothing else to talk about this evening, could easily use up all of our time and ought to use up our time every day if we are parents. Men ought to decide early on that their goal is to rule their children well, to bring up their children as well as they can in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. There's just few opportunities we have that are more precious than the opportunity to be an influence in the life of our children throughout their entire life. We can change their life. We can direct their life if that's what we choose to do. And yet, I think too often we tend to delegate a great deal more of this responsibility to the mothers and to our wives than what we ought to do. And I've thought about, even in my responsibilities as a father, and we've tried to not simply delegate it one way or the other, that we'll share this responsibility. There's no doubt in my mind that Kay thinks about our children and what's going on in their life and how they're affected far more than I do. And I wish I wasn't so distracted on other things. I need to spend more time thinking about them and planning for them and show that same kind of interest. And that's the responsibility I think all husbands have, all fathers rather have, is to be so concerned about their children. This is a goal that's on their mind all the time. And each thing that they do, they're concerned about what effect it has on their children. But of course, there are some other spiritual goals, and we've already said that Paul talks about to Timothy and to Titus, or really rather to Timothy, about how he should encourage men to be deacons and what the qualifications of a deacon are. I think that a deacon, and to a large extent, is really not much more than a servant of the Lord who has a specific and ongoing responsibility. And because of that, it ought to be something that we would desire to be. If we have an opportunity, we ought to desire to be a deacon so that we know that we're going to have these opportunities to help other people and to serve God. Now, there are plenty of opportunities out there. Don't mistake me, or don't misunderstand me. We always have those opportunities. But to know within the church you have an ongoing responsibility is a privilege. And as a result, I think that men ought to desire deeply to be a deacon. But how much more of a goal it should be to desire to be an elder. To have as a goal that you would serve as one who would be a shepherd over the souls of other people. In the letter to Timothy, the first letter in chapter 3, Paul says, this is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop, and that's just the position of an elder, he desires a good work. It's a good work. But it seems to me, and I'm not trying to criticize Paul's choice of words or the Holy Spirit, it seems like you could go on. It's even more than just a good work. What an honorable work. What an important work it is that an elder has. It would be a privilege to have an opportunity to directly influence the lives of so many people through the actions that an elder takes. And what an awesome responsibility that it is. When we were studying these letters to Timothy and Titus in the 4th and 5th grade class, I was trying to figure out how could I explain to them what an elder is and what an elder is supposed to do. And I don't remember where I heard this, but I know I heard it from here, and I think I heard it from some of the elders. So how they, the elders here, view their responsibility. Their responsibility in their mind is summarized as being to get the most people they possibly can here to heaven. To help as many people here as they can to make it to heaven. That's what all of their mind is set upon and all of the things that they do. They simply want to help other people make it to heaven. That's a great goal to have. And I would like to hope that there are many men here tonight who've already set in their mind a goal that one day they want to be an elder. It's not something that happens by chance. You've got to desire it. You've got to plan for it. When I was in high school, I was a part of a congregation that was probably a little larger even than this congregation. And at that time, there were no elders. And they had elders later, quite a few years later, but the elders that they had were relatively young. They were qualified to be elders, but the point is, there was obviously a long gap of time in that congregation when no man was able to step forward, or at least not two men, able to step forward and to be qualified and prepared to serve as elders. And I contrast that to this congregation where not only do we have four fine elders, but in my mind, I can think of at least a dozen men who over the next 10 to 20 years ought to become elders if they simply continue on the spiritual path that they're on now. That's a tremendous blessing to be among that many people who might achieve that. But the important thing is we've got to set that as a goal. And I'd like to encourage you, if you're a man here and you have that opportunity, that you desire to be an elder. But all of this is really done through our character. If we're going to achieve spiritual goals such as this, we've really got to achieve them from the inside. That's not as true as that isn't really the case with most of our worldly accomplishments. For example, if you've set a goal of having a certain kind of career, or you want to reach a certain position in your career, maybe a certain salary level, along the way, there are a lot of very tangible accomplishments that you can point to. You might, for example, have to go to a very specific kind of school and get a very specific degree. You might have to have a grade point average that's at least a certain level. And to get what you really want, you might have to take a job with a very limited number of companies. But along the way, if you've got that kind of a goal, you know what those physical, tangible accomplishments are that you have to hit in order to achieve your ultimate goal. But these goals that we've listed here are really ones that we're going to achieve only if we develop the kind of character that God expects of both men and women. But if men are going to achieve these goals, they've got to develop a certain kind of character. And I think that that character was described to Timothy in the very first chapter. If you would turn over to 1 Timothy 1 with verse 5, where Paul begins to talk about spiritual character. In this, he's actually told Timothy that he wanted him to remain in Ephesus and to correct some teaching and some things that were going on in Ephesus they shouldn't have. And most of it seems to center around people who were disputing and arguing over things that were of really of no value. And in verse 5, he says to Timothy that the purpose of the commandment, and I still can't figure out whether he means the commandment of you staying there in Ephesus, the end result's going to be this thing, or if it's just the commandment of correcting people from getting all excited about things that weren't important. But what is clear is that the end result, the end of the commandment, was something important that every person needed to have. He says the end of the commandment, or the purpose of the commandment, rather, is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. And I think those three things very well describe the kind of character that we should want to develop as children of God. He first says here that you need to develop a pure heart. And I think that that's mostly centered around our thoughts. A heart is our inward man. He's saying that your thoughts, your inward man needs to be characterized as being pure. The word pure here has the idea of having been cleansed. And even more than just having been cleansed, to be free from the mixture of anything at all that would soil it or make it unclean. In regard to our thoughts, there's really an opportunity in reading passages like this to apply a test to ourselves. Can we say that our thoughts are such that they're free from anything that would cause us to not be clean or not be seen as being right in the sight of God? There's an interesting test I think you could apply from Titus, the first chapter. And look over in Titus 1, verse 15. Paul had some other things to say to Titus about purity. He says in verse 15 that to the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their mind and conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, and in works they deny Him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. Now, I'm still pondering exactly what this passage means. But I think I have an application of whether that's what he meant here. I think you'll see is certainly an appropriate application of spiritual principles, regardless. But I really think to a large degree, he's saying that there is a person whose mind and whose thoughts are so pure that the circumstances and situations they come into, they apply themselves or go into those situations with thoughts that really are pure. And they don't think about or see or have the kind of evil desires that other people might have in exactly the same situation. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and maybe you can figure out how this applies better to you. If I were to ask you to close your eyes for a moment and just picture a beautiful beach, sandy white beach on a sunshiny day, nice warm weather. What would you see after a few moments? Would you see simply the beauty of nature and the power of the surf and how God has created a world such as that? Or would you begin to perhaps see people that maybe are not dressed in an appropriate way? And think along that line. If you were at a beach, would that be what caught your attention? Or would it be really the beauty of nature and those things? See, to the pure, we see pure things. But to those that are not pure, they find all kinds of occasions on which to see and to recognize and to think about things that really are not appropriate. What if I were to tell you, and this would be exciting, what if I were to tell you that tomorrow you're going to be paid a large bonus, biggest bonus you've ever got? You went home tonight and began to think about, this is great. I'm going to get all of this money. What would you think about during the course of this evening about all of that money, more than you've ever gotten before in abundance? How are you going to spend it? Are you thinking about things you might spend it on that really aren't all that appropriate, maybe frivolous, maybe have only to do with worldly things? And believe me, I'd fail most of this test. I'd have come up with a number of very material things along the way. But at some point, do we begin to think about what that money might mean to us spiritually, how we can use it for good? How it might be a temptation to us, and we need to be careful about certain things. How it might be something we could use prudently. Somewhere in there, there ought to be some spiritual thoughts. And to the pure, who approach blessings, who approach circumstances in life, who approach people, they see pure things. They see opportunities to teach. They see opportunities to do good things. But to those that are not pure, he says here, really their mind is defiled and nothing is pure. They're not able to see anything good. It's important for us to develop a pure heart. But not only that, he says here also in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 5 that we are to develop a sincere faith. Now, if you're reading from the King James Version or from the American Standard Version, I think what you'll find the word here is unfeigned. And that's not a word we use a lot. We kind of know what sincere is, but it may be that it's hard. But what does he mean by a sincere faith? The word that's translated here that describes faith really just simply means not acting, not pretending. You've got a faith which doesn't act. It doesn't pretend. It's with complete sincerity. And it's very interesting, in 2 Timothy, the first chapter and verse 5, same chapter, same verse, but the second letter. The word here is also used to describe the faith that Timothy has. But if you have the New King James Version, you'll look over there and it says that Timothy had a genuine faith. I pondered this. I'm not sure why the translators chose to use the same Greek word, but one place they say sincere and another one genuine. But either one fits pretty well. It's a faith that doesn't act. It's unhypocritical. It doesn't pretend. It's sincere. It's a genuine faith that we have. And again, I think this is an opportunity for us to test ourselves and to see whether or not we have this kind of faith. What's implied here is that we don't just simply have a faith that acknowledges certain things that the Bible teaches, but when we truly believe that the Bible says something and that it's from God, it causes us to act in a certain way. I don't always find my faith to be a sincere, unfeigned faith. Now let me just give you an example of where I think I've failed in this, and maybe you can think of some where you've struggled. I fully believe that Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14, where it talks about the fact that there's a broad way that leads to destruction, and many there are that are on that, and then there's a narrow way that leads to life, and only few are going to find it. I believe that what that is saying is that most people are lost. I'm convinced of that. I really have no doubt that that's what the Bible teaches, and the Bible is from God, and that's the truth. But if you were to walk with me throughout the week, you would see that much of my actions toward other people don't seem to indicate that I think that at all. There aren't that many occasions where I really treat people as if they are lost and there's something desperate in regard to our relationship, something I need to be doing. I think to the extent that while I have this faith, and it is an accurate faith, but I don't have the actions that go along with it, it's hard to say this is an unfeigned faith. An unhypocritical one. I think this sincere faith is really the motivation of a spiritual man. It's what makes him act. I believe these things and I'm going to act accordingly to that belief. But not only that, and I forgot to mention, and you probably already said, why did he put those out of order? That's a little license I took. Because I think the development goes from our thoughts to those things that motivate us to finally those things that we do. In that 1 Timothy 1 and verse 5, it says we need to have a good conscience. And the word good here may simply mean something like a clear conscience. That is, we ought to have a conscience that results from good actions. If I'm doing good things, then my conscience is going to be clear. It's not going to be accusing me. And that's certainly something we'd all like to have. But what I think we really need in our spiritual life is a useful conscience. One that's helpful. To us. One that's going to do some things for us. You know, a conscience is really not a static possession. It's not something that you just have that's going to stay just like it is. I think a conscience is always going to go off in one of two different directions. And the Bible really talks about a conscience changing in certain ways. A conscience could change to the extent that it's been seared. And Paul even talks to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2 about the possibility that your conscience, because you keep doing things wrong, eventually it's just seared. It doesn't tell you anything. But in Hebrews 5 and verse 14, it talks about the fact that mature Christians are those that have had their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Isn't that what a conscience is? It tells you what's right and what's wrong. And wouldn't you like to have a conscience that's been exercised, that's used the scriptures, that's listened to other people who are spiritually minded, and has developed and changed to the point that your conscience really knows what's right and what's wrong? You know, what I want in my spiritual life is a conscience that will keep me awake at night when I've done something wrong. It doesn't do that too often. You know, I feel bad about having done something wrong, But what I really need is a conscience that causes me to, I can't sleep because I know I've done something that's wrong that needs to be changed. That's a useful conscience. I want a conscience that has developed from so much Bible study and from talking to other Christians that when I come into a situation and I don't know really what's right or not, it just kind of tells me which way I should go. You know, there's some things that you think about doing, but it just doesn't feel right. Well, I want a conscience that sometimes just doesn't feel right because it isn't right. And maybe I don't know why. I can't explain it. But I know this. My conscience is telling me that's probably not the best thing to do. And then, of course, we should listen to that conscience. That's a conscience that would be truly helpful to us. And there's one other thing, too, in regard to the character of a spiritual man. And that is from 1 Timothy 2. I couldn't get all of this out of 1 Timothy 1, verse 5. But in chapter 2 and verse 8, he talks about the fact that he would have men everywhere to pray. And I think there are certain spiritual activities that are expected of men. And we'll talk a little bit more about those in just a second. In the fourth chapter of 1 Timothy, down in verse 11, he begins to say some very personal things to Timothy. And I want us to recognize, as both men and women, that we have a great deal of opportunities to influence other people, to do what's right. But particularly if our goal is to eventually be an elder, then along the way we're going to have many opportunities to help people, to teach people, to be an influence in the lives of men and women and helping them to make it to heaven. But in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 11, Paul tells Timothy that what he first needs to do is to be an example in a number of ways. He needs to be an example, he says, in word and conduct, and love, and spirit, and faith, and purity. Now, I think you could take those six things he says to him he needs to be an example in, fit most all of them in the 1 Timothy 1:5. The word and the conduct, if he would do those things appropriately, he'd have a good conscience. It talks about purity and faith again. We've already talked about that. The idea of love is also in 1 Timothy 1:5, though we didn't really mention much of that. But to possess those qualities and then have the character that we've talked about throughout all of this lesson, it was essential that Timothy engage himself in certain spiritual activities. He wasn't just going to get these things by accident. He had to do something in order to acquire all of those parts or qualities of his character. And so he's told in verse 13 to give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Down in verse 15, he's told to meditate on these things and give yourself entirely to them. Just give yourself over to these spiritual things, to the thoughts and to your reading and to your understanding of what God has revealed to us. It was to be an ongoing activity of Timothy. But if he would do that, two favorable things would result. He's told down in the bottom of this, verse 16, that he was to take heed to himself and to the doctrine, continue in them, for in doing this you will save both yourself and those who hear you. Timothy, you have an opportunity, not only to save your own soul, but to save the souls of others, to be an influence to them. As your progress, he says in verse 15, is evident to others, and they'll see it, you'll have an opportunity to save yourself and to save others. The fact of the matter is, if we fail to grow spiritually as we are supposed to, eventually other people are going to suffer. It's inevitable. If, as men and women, we fail to do what we need to do spiritually so that we mature, those around us who see us, they're going to suffer in some spiritual way. Eventually, our teaching will not be as effective. And I worry about that a lot. I know that I can whip up a lesson quickly and teach it. But it's not going to be effective unless there's a life behind it that is truly given over to the Lord. Our example won't be as appealing to people. They'll wonder about certain things. They'll wonder about things they've heard about us or seen in us. It doesn't seem to match the rest of our life. And it won't be as effective as it once was. Our desire to help other people eventually will fade away. And while there's an opportunity in front of us, we won't use it because we haven't progressed spiritually as we should. Our children will suffer. There are things that we may struggle with in our life that we look and say, well, I don't want my children to struggle with those things spiritually. But unless we overcome them, how can we really hope to be the influence in the life of our children that we want to be? It's important for us to decide that we will first change ourselves because we do have an influence over others. And the dangers that are implied in this, the dire consequences that result when a person does not change themselves, it's not a theory. Because in these same letters to Timothy and to Titus, Paul speaks about some people who really fail to do what they were supposed to. Look back in the second chapter, rather the first chapter of 1 Timothy, down in verse 19. He says to Timothy, that there are some who have rejected faith and a good conscience. Those were two of the things we said you had to have. He said, having faith and a good conscience, which some having rejected concerning the faith have suffered shipwreck, of whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander. Here are two men who fell away. They could have helped a lot of people, but their faith suffered shipwreck because they didn't have a good conscience. And they didn't have faith. Didn't develop the way it was supposed to. And Demas is said in the second letter to Timothy in chapter 4 and verse 10, to have forsaken me, having loved this present world. That's nothing more than the opposite of that pure heart, one that's focused on God, but to one that's now loving the present world. It begins to soil that heart. And that's what Demas did. And I've wondered, I wish I knew more about that Demas. Maybe we're not supposed to, but I've wondered sometimes about this man who obviously had been of such help to Paul to even be named here, but the world got him. It pulled at him and took him away. And it did that because he didn't develop the character that he wanted to. I'd like to encourage all of us to make up our minds that we're going to progress and we're going to grow as we should. And if you've never become a child of God, tonight you have an opportunity to have a great blessing, to have your sins forgiven and to become a part of the family of God. You need to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that He died for our sins, and you need to be willing to confess that faith before others and to repent, change your mind. I'm not going to act the way I've done before. I'm going to be directed by God, and to be baptized so that your sins might be forgiven and washed away. But if you're a child of God and you've struggled and you've not done the things that you should have, and if in a public manner that's obvious, you have caused others to be harmed spiritually, if it's a public sin, why not publicly confess it tonight and show others your intention to save yourself and to help others to be saved as well? We encourage you to do whatever you need to as we stand and as we sing.
Hear the sweet voice of Jesus say, come unto me.